1 Peter 3, 1-7, the seventh talk in a series on 1 Peter, was presented by Ron Julian on August 16, 2009, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So, we're in 1 Peter continuing today. I'm teaching on one of those passages that almost guarantees that you're going to get somebody mad. We're in chapter 3. Starting with verse 1, let me just read the part that we're going to talk about today. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, as they observe the way you conduct yourself with deference and purity. And let not your adornment be external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but rather the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Thus Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. You husbands likewise live with your wives in an understanding way, as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Well, surely there's at least a half a dozen statements in there that's going to get somebody upset. So I thought about trying to find a way of talking about this that's going to leave me unscathed at the end, and I figured there isn't any way to do it, so I might as well just tell you what I think. So that's what I'm going to do. My goal this morning is to take what Peter is saying seriously and try to explain as clearly and accurately as I can what I think Peter has in mind. So let's jump in. Let me start by talking about the concept of submission, first of all. I think this will help us as we go into this. Why would God ever tell me to submit to another human being? Why is that ever an issue? Why doesn't God just say, you follow me and forget what anybody else says about anything? Well, there are at least two reasons. Maybe there are more, but there are two that strike me, and I think it's very important to distinguish between them. First of all, I think it is a biblical concept that God wants me to submit to those who have a rightful authority. Obviously, Jesus has a rightful authority as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and it is right and appropriate for me to submit to him. He says to do something, and I should do it. In this life, other human beings have a limited authority that it is appropriate that I submit to. The word is limited, and we'll see that that's very important. But, for example, at Gutenberg College, where I work, the president is answerable to the board of governors. If the board's wishes are not carried out, it is the president who will answer for it. And as we have the president here and have the board members, so I can get myself in trouble. Good. That's my goal this morning. So I, as an employee of Gutenberg College, have, I think, before God, a moral obligation to respect the responsibility that has been given to the president. Responsibility and authority go together. God wants me to be a godly person, and part of being a godly person is recognizing that David has an authority before the board that I do not. He's answerable to them in a way that I am not, and it is appropriate and even loving for me to recognize the responsibility that he has and submit to it, even if I think it would be better to do it another way. So that's an example of the kind of situation where there is an appropriate authority that I would recognize, yes, this is, I ought to submit to this for the sake of the fact that it is right to submit to that authority. That authority God approves of, and I'm submitting to it because of that. Now, we might ask whether the husband and wife relationship is like that in God's eyes. Does the husband have some sort of unique responsibility before God that makes it appropriate for the wife to submit in that area? This is the whole concept of headship. Paul talks about the husband being the head of the wife, and there's much debate that has gone on about what did he mean by that and what is the significance of that. And people have argued on both sides. Let me just say, most of you know that I would answer that yes, in a limited way, there is a unique responsibility that a husband has in marriage. But having said that, that's not our topic this morning. We could talk about that another time, and maybe I'm wrong about that altogether, but I don't think that's our issue this morning. I don't think that's what Peter is talking about in this passage. So I want to move on to the second reason that God might ask me to submit to someone. And let's take, for example, I've mentioned this kind of thing several times, but the teaching of Jesus, like in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has told us that when someone strikes us on the right cheek, we should turn the other cheek to him as well. Okay, so did he say that because he's saying I should recognize the God-given authority that that person has to hit me in the face? No. Does Jesus believe that the person was right to hit me in the face? No, not necessarily. I'm not responding by indicating you did the right thing and I'm acknowledging it by submitting to it. And yet, Jesus calls us to not fight back at sometimes against clearly unjust actions, but to submit, to take it, and in fact indicate my willingness to submit to it. And why does he do that? And my understanding of why he does that is because we have been called to love our enemies. The idea is that we are to think about what we are communicating to the other person. That idea is that I am, in various ways, in various situations in life, taking the opportunity to indicate that even though you have mistreated me, even though I don't agree with what you're doing, still I respect you as a person and I care about you. As I said, I think we are called upon always to communicate to people that we serve God and love them. And there are times when submission is not an indication that I agree that the person had the right to do what they did, but I am seeking to communicate to them that I serve God and love them. Okay, so I think that this second reason is what Peter has in mind throughout this section. Peter is talking to people to Christians living in a pagan world where the people around them are inclined to look down on them as Christians and to be looking and thinking about what their actions say about them as believers. Peter calls them to submit to a pagan government that is far from godly in order to put the lie to the idea that somehow they are seditious or enemies of the good that the state is trying to promote. Peter calls slaves to submit to masters who are unjustly mistreating them. Does God approve of the behavior of the master? No. Does the master have some right before God to mistreat slaves? No. But the slave submits anyway to serve God's redemptive purpose, to keep the lines of communication open with the other person, to recognize I am a person who cares about what is right and can be trusted to be on your side in a significant way. Well, I think Peter has exactly the same issue in mind with wives and husbands here. Notice that he concentrates on the wife whose husband is disobedient to the word, that is, an unbeliever. Peter doesn't say submit because he has every right to tell you what to do. He says submit so that you might win him. So the submission that we're talking about here is a voluntary giving up of what I think I might otherwise be entitled to for the sake of communicating to the other person that I, as a believer, am a person of character and worth considering the faith that I have embraced. That's what I think Peter is getting at. So I'll explain this as I go along. But so, if you understand, although I do think there is a biblical concept of headship in marriage, I don't think you could prove that from 1 Peter. I don't think you could use this passage to demonstrate that that's the case. Peter's concerns are different. He is writing to Christians living in a social relationship that they cannot escape from, to Christian citizens living under a pagan government, to Christian slaves living under unbelieving masters, to Christian wives married to unbelieving husbands. And his advice is the same to all. As Christians, we're aliens and strangers in the world. When possible, show the unbelieving world that you are a person of virtue by behaving in a submissive and respectful way. I think that's what he's getting at. So let's go through it now and see if that makes some sense. Start in 3:1. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives as they observe the way you conduct yourself with deference and purity. I don't want to get into all of the little details of interpretation that we might sort out, but I do want to mention one because it came up last week as well, and we're going to see it again still. Literally, this sentence ends with a phrase that is like, as they observe your in fear, pure conduct. So this is conduct done in fear that he's saying. What is the word fear doing there? What is he getting at? A few sentences down, Peter urges the wives with the same word not to be frightened with any fear. So he's not telling them to be afraid of their husbands, because just below he says, don't be, I would say. They should trust God and not fear in this situation with their husbands. So what is he saying here? And we have this choice that we have to go with. One option is that he is implying fear of God, that even though he doesn't use the phrase of God, that when he says in fear, conducting yourself in fear, that it is out of a godly fear, a fear of God, that you should live. That's clearly true. That's clearly part of Peter's thinking, that my response to the one who is above me is predicated really on my submission to God and what he wants me to do rather than what the person wants me to do. So that would make sense. It would make perfectly good sense if that was the case. And maybe that's what he means. But it is interesting that three times in this book, Peter talks about how we should respond to another person, how we should conduct ourselves toward someone, and he uses this phrase that we should conduct ourselves toward them in fear. He doesn't use the phrase fear of God, he just says fear. And in each case, he's talking about the response that we have toward another person. Is it possible that fear in certain contexts means something more like respect, submission, deference, or something like that? Well, as far as I could tell, there's only one passage in the New Testament that seems to clearly suggest that that might be the case. And this is in Romans 13, famous passage, you know, submit to authorities and all that stuff, similar to what Peter has been talking about here in a number of ways. And in Romans 13:7, Paul says, render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. And it strikes me there, in that place, that he seems to, all the others in the list, seem to be talking about some obligation in a social setting. I am a citizen and there is a tax owed and I should pay the taxes that that I am being called on. There's a king who should be honored as a king, and it is appropriate for me to honor the king as the king, and so forth. So when he says, fear to whom fear, it sounds as if he's suggesting that there are people that it is appropriate for me to fear, and I should render them the fear that is due them. So I'm not sure about this, but it seems to me to make sense that the word fear in those contexts means something like deference, that I am acting toward the other person as if they have some power over me, and I'm acknowledging that that's the case. So act in a deferential way, acknowledging that you have some social obligation to the other person. An example would be a citizen to a king, a slave to a master, and in this case, a wife to a husband. So I think that's why I ended up translating that phrase as they observe the way you conduct yourself with deference and purity. So if I had to vote today, that's where I'd go. It's tricky, though. I can understand the arguments on the other side. Now there's a little detail. Let's back up and try to get the bigger picture here. What is Peter telling the wife? What is this advice? The issue, I would argue, is once again the problem of being an alien and stranger in the world as a Christian. A Christian wife may find herself thinking quite differently from her husband, and what is she going to do about that? Let's remember, I think it is significant in this situation because I think it is a cultural reality into which Peter is speaking, that the cultural situation is somewhat different than our own. A woman had fewer legal rights than her husband, although there were variations on that, as I understand it. The man had the power over his household, and in many ways, the wife had her place in that household just as a slave might. I mean, in some ways, you could picture the wife as being the most important servant in the house. The expectation was that she would take care of the household. The husband would be in control of the religion practiced in the house. The expectation was also that she would reflect well on her husband. Her role was to be a modest, faithful, supportive, respectful, industrious wife. So we have a situation here, as I'm understanding it, where the wife has chosen to go against the family religion. What Peter wants is for her to conduct herself in such a way that her faith is not equated with rebellion and disrespect for her husband. She is already at odds with him somewhat, but he is encouraging her not to push that beyond what is necessary due to her faith. The situation might be so extreme that the husband is actively disobedient to the word. That is, he has heard this gospel, this proclamation that his wife believes, and he rejects it. He doesn't buy it, he doesn't obey it, he doesn't want it. Well, so in her situation, he's heard it and he doesn't want to hear any more about it. He has no intention of submitting to it. So if you can't use words, then communicate without words, he's saying. I think he is telling the wives to be that the respectful wives that their husbands and society expect. Take her place in the household, raise her children, take care of the home without complaint. She can't submit to the husband's religious beliefs, but she can communicate to him that she is still interested in being a good wife to him. The goal is to use the means of communication that she has open to her. And that's been true in all three sections we have looked at. The Christian citizen can quiet the slander about Christians by being respectful citizens. The Christian slave can earn the hearing of ungodly masters by respectfully fulfilling their responsibilities, even if they're being mistreated. The Christian wife can earn a hearing with her unbelieving husband by faithfully fulfilling her role as a respectful and morally upright wife. She's communicating that even though she has set herself against him, in a sense, in embracing this faith, that she is not his enemy, and she is not dismissing him as an appropriate husband or whatever. In doing so, she might win him. That is, he might be willing to reconsider his attitude toward the gospel as he sees the character of his wife. I think basically that's what Peter is suggesting in this context. Okay, so going on then, and let not your adornment be external, braiding the hair and wearing gold jewelry or putting on dresses, but rather the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. Okay, now it might seem like a non sequitur here. We're talking about submitting to your husband. Now we're talking about jewelry. What is this, just sort of Peter wants to tell women what to do about various things, or what is he getting at here? I think we're still on the same topic, and that becomes clear as we go along, I think. The last sentence ended by picturing the husband observing his wife and seeing her respectfully pure behavior. Here's this husband, unbelieving though he is, he's watching his wife. So one way a wife might adorn herself for a watching husband is through external beauty aids. And indeed, as history attests, women have often used physical beauty as a way of securing the goodwill of men. I mean, this is just a reality. This is what has happened. Peter is saying, I think, that the more significant and important adornment is that which starts in the heart and shows itself in a gentle and quiet spirit. Out of a heart of belief and trust in God, I am not being contentious and arraying myself against my husband, but I am with gentleness and quietness responding in this situation in a way that it adorns my life. My husband can't help but notice that there is something attractive, something noticeable about the way I live my life. Even though the wife has gone against him in her religion, if she is a woman of character who is a respectful wife, this will get his attention. And Peter says that this gentle and quiet spirit is precious to God. And I think in verse 5, which I know has some stuff that sounds bad in it, but I think we see in verse 5 why it is that he would say that this is precious to God. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Thus Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. Let me just comment here. You'll notice that the picture now is still adorning yourself, and it is the submission and quietness with which they have adorned themselves. So I think that shows us that even in the part about the jewelry, the issue was the response to the husband. In what way are you adorning yourself such that the husband is going to look at this? All right, so now I cannot think otherwise but to imagine that some of you, maybe all of us here, have these alarm bells go off when we see this language about Sarah calling Abraham Lord. There is probably not one wife in this room who calls her husband Lord. I'll bet. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands because it would just be too confusing whatever happened. But let's just grant that probably there is not one wife in this room that calls her husband Lord. And and I won't go into that. I need to be very careful as to what I say here. Okay, so what's this? I mean, what is Peter getting at here? I mean, what is he trying to point out? Okay, first of all, let's notice at least that this was not an unusual way for a wife to speak in Abraham's time. It's not that Sarah one day said, "Why, Abraham, you're not just my husband, you're my Lord." I mean, it's not like that. It was a common way for a wife to speak to a husband at the time. And we also need to recognize that the word Lord doesn't always have the connotation that we associate with it when we talk about Jesus being Lord. The word could be used something closer to sir, it's a name of respect, of deference to someone else. But it's hard for us, I think, to exactly get the feel of what that word would have meant in her mouth. But what I think is more important, that's trivial, I think, in comparison to a more important point here. We want to notice what Peter is not saying. I mean, this doesn't prove that he wouldn't say it, but he's not saying it here. He is not saying, Sarah knew that God's eternal commandment was that wives should call their husbands Lord and always obey them no matter what they said to do. What he says is, he gives Sarah as a model of a woman who hoped in God, and then he says that Christian wives would be Sarah's children if they do what is right without being frightened by any fear. So I think the model that Sarah is being given is not that he's saying Sarah and Abraham's marriage is the model for what every Christian marriage should look like, but in that the wife should call her husband Lord and she should respond to him just the way Sarah did to Abraham. What he's advocating is that the women here look at Sarah as a model of faith in the midst of her marriage. Sarah is being given as a model who was willing to submit to Abraham without fear because her true trust was in God. Abraham was not as trustworthy as God. Abraham was not a person that you could count on necessarily to always do the right thing. I don't know if Peter has this in mind, but what is the most striking bit of submission that we see in Sarah's life? Two times, Abraham says to her, I'm afraid that if somebody finds out that you're my wife, that they will kill me and take you. So I want you to pretend that you're my sister. And then she pretends that he's his sister, and so naturally a guy comes along and takes her and marries her. And in both of those situations, God ends up rescuing the situation. And, I mean, we can picture God blesses Abraham through, gets all this stuff out of it and everything. But it's also true that God rescues Sarah from the difficult position that Abraham has put her in. So I think that we have no reason to believe that Peter is picturing Sarah's relations with Abraham as the ideal Christian marriage, that the Christian husband should treat his wife the way Abraham treated Sarah and vice versa. He is picturing Sarah as a godly woman who submitted because her true trust was in God. And I think that's his focus. You'll be her children if you do what is right without fearing, that you put your trust in God. Peter is acknowledging here, I think, that a Christian wife's situation in this time, especially in the Roman Empire, could be a fearful one. She is a woman under the power of an unbelieving man in a society where the power rests with him. That could be a very scary place to be. We don't see Peter here endorsing the current cultural phenomenon of marriage in the first century Roman Empire, but he is acknowledging that that is the context in which they have to make their decisions about how they're going to behave. He's calling on her to live out faith in the context of her marriage. Out of true love, she should communicate with her behavior that she serves God and truly cares about her husband. It is that trusting hope in God that is precious in the sight of God. And every single one of us as Christians, man or woman, married or not, is called upon to trust God in this way as we interact with other human beings. We are called to sacrifice ourselves for the sake of others, trusting God to take care of us. And that's the model that Peter is calling the wives to embrace here. Put their hope in God and do what is God's will in this situation, which is to, as much as possible with their behavior, communicate to their unbelieving husbands. Okay. He finishes off by turning to the husbands here. And now he's speaking to a slightly different situation. He's not talking to those disobedient to the word husbands. He's talking to Christian husbands about how they should treat their Christian wives. He says, "You husbands, likewise, live with your wives in an understanding way, as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman, and grant her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered." Yeah, I know. This sounds really bad. How condescending. Husbands, try to be understanding. She's only a woman. So, you know, you should treat her as if she's an equal, even though, of course, we know she really isn't. I mean, that's what it sounds like he's saying, which would be really awful if that's, in fact, what he's saying. But I think that's not at all what he's saying. And, in fact, this is a powerful statement in the other direction if we look at and come to understand what he's dealing with here. Remember, Peter just got done talking to the wife about hoping in God and not giving in to fear. Why? What would she have to fear? Well, especially in that cultural situation, and this is often true in many cultural situations, but her situation is a very vulnerable one. He's the one who has the power in the marriage relationship in the Roman Empire. She is submitting herself to someone who has not submitted himself to the will of God. And so that's a scary place to be. Well, I think that's what Peter has in mind as he turns it back around then on the Christian husband. Hers is the weaker vessel. Her body, her life situation is weaker. The husband is in the stronger position than the wife. He is physically stronger. He is socially stronger. I do not think that Peter is making a comment about the inherent moral fiber or personal fortitude or whatever about women. She's not a weaker vessel in the sense that she is less able to do what is right or less able to face into hardship bravely or whatever we might be looking at there. Look at what he just said. He's talking to Christian women who are married to unbelievers, and he's calling on them to exercise this incredible courage based on the fact that she is trusting God, even though she can't really trust her husband. So I don't think it makes sense that he's coming along to say she's somewhat defective, so be nice to her. What he's saying is, look, that situation that she's in, that's a reality. You have the upper hand. You're stronger than she is, and you have the social power. You really are in a position that you could mistreat her and get away with it. Peter is exhorting Christian husbands to remember that their wives are in a vulnerable position. Husbands had the approval of society to treat their wives in a way that a fellow believer should not be treated. Nature and society has given the husband the upper hand, but he shouldn't use it. Instead, he should remember that his believing wife is in fact a fellow heir of the grace of life. So he in fact should treat her with the godly love and deference that he would treat any other believer with. She is in a socially vulnerable and less honorable position, but he should honor her and raise her up. What is deficient about her situation, he should remedy by acknowledging her equality as a fellow believer and honoring her in a way that deficit is made up. So I don't think there's anything condescending at all about what Peter is saying here. As a human being, the wife is not weaker or inferior to the husband in any way, but she is at a disadvantage and somewhat at the mercy of her husband. A Christian husband in that situation is called upon to erase that disadvantage, to honor her as an equal instead of treating her like an underling. So if she's married to an unbeliever, she may not receive that honor from him and she should submit to it. But a Christian husband should not settle for that and should give her the honor that she deserves. Okay, Peter says that Christian husbands should do this so your prayers will not be hindered. And that's an interesting phrase and a little difficult to sort out. Why would he say a thing like that? First of all, I understand the "you're" to be addressed to the husbands here. Husbands, if you want your prayers to be unhindered, you need to honor your wives. It is common to take this language as saying, things are not going to go as well for you if you don't honor your wives. So here you are, you're a Christian, and you're saved, and you're going to heaven, but you might be praying to God that, you know, get a better job or something like that, but God's not going to be as inclined to listen to you if you're not treating your wife well. So you should be treating your wife well so that God is more likely to give you what you want. Or maybe if it's not like that, sometimes people connect it like with, well, maybe your prayers specifically are prayers that your family life would go well or something. But of course, your family life isn't going to go well if you're not treating your wife well, and so your prayers won't be answered in that way. I suppose that's possible, but I don't think that's what's happening here. I'm very strongly inclined to think that's not what he means. First of all, I don't think that that is the biblical picture of prayer. This idea that somehow my results with God kind of go up and down depending on how much sin I have in my life. I just don't think that's a biblical picture. If God only answers the prayers of those who don't sin, then we might as well give up praying altogether because it's just not going to get anywhere. It seems to me that there is a more comprehensive picture of prayer in the Bible. I mean, sometimes prayer is a specific, here's a believer asking, you know, can I do this or not do this or something. But fundamentally, each of us is coming to God with this prayer. I am calling out to God, listen to me. I need help. I need life. I need rescue. And the question is God going to hear me or not? Is God going to heed my call or is he going to turn away? I think we get a clue if we look a little farther on at verse 12 in Peter, where he's quoting from the Old Testament, where it says, "For the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil." Now, sounds like it's contradicting what I just said a minute ago, but by righteous here, I think we need to picture those who are the people of God, the people of faith, those who trust and follow God, whose faith is real, whose hearts are genuinely turned towards God. God is against those who rebel against him by giving their lives over to evil, but he hears the prayers of those who trust and follow him. And we're going to see when we get to this section that this is basically all a part of Peter's admonition to us to conduct ourselves in an appropriate way as believers as we're interacting with other people. So he is actually picturing that whether I am a person of real faith or not is tied to whether I am living in a way that reflects that in the way I deal with other people. So this is an either-or life and death kind of situation that he's describing. Either you are a person of faith, in which case your prayers are heard and you will find life, or you are not a person of faith and God has turned away from you. That's what he says a couple verses down. So I think that Peter is saying to the so-called Christian husband, if you want your prayers to actually be heard by God, if you don't want God to turn away from your cry to him, then you need to be living out a genuine faith from the heart. And part of living out a genuine faith from the heart is responding to God's people, to see God's people as worthy of honor and respect as God's people, and that means being willing to honor and respect your wife, fellow believer, as one of God's people. I think that really makes a lot of sense in the context of 1 Peter. 1 Peter has been all about the testing of our faith. We are being called to live as if we actually believe that the gospel is true. And one of the key issues is whether we acknowledge that Christ's people are our people. Peter has already said earlier on that we are called to have a sincere love for the brethren that arises out of our embracing the truth of the gospel. Since the gospel is true, you are my people, and I am called upon to love you as my people. Well, my believing wife is one of the brethren. If a husband is ultimately unwilling to abandon his physical and social advantage over his wife and treat her with honor and respect as a fellow believer, then he's really not willing to see her as a fellow heir. He's really not willing to see her as one who is in fact one of his brothers and sisters in Christ. He is not loving the brethren. It is actually a rubber meets the road opportunity for me to decide whether the people of God mean anything to me. So I think he means it very seriously. And I'll talk about that here as we, let me make a few final comments then about what I think is going on here, what this adds up to. First of all, let me say again, I don't think Peter is telling us much about whether there is a Christian concept of headship in marriage. I think that there is a place for the headship of the husband in marriage. It needs to be understood carefully what that means. But even if that were not true, even if the Bible taught that the ideal was a totally egalitarian marriage, maybe I'm wrong, maybe headship is not a biblical concept, but even if I'm wrong and the Bible were saying that other thing, I don't think that Peter would change a word in this particular section. Peter is addressing the situation of a Christian wife in a socially oppressive situation. Just as Peter is not endorsing a master mistreating his slave, so Peter is not endorsing a husband lording it over his wife. But if a wife finds herself with an unbelieving husband, how should she respond? She is to love her enemy. She is to show her husband respect and deference, so that her faith is not interpreted by him as rebellion and hostility. That's what I think he's getting at. When properly understood, Christian submission is a beautiful thing, but I think it is often profoundly misunderstood, and it gets really ugly if it goes bad. So let me just make a comment about that. It seems to me that almost all discussions among Christians about submission tend to miss the point. We ask ourselves, are we supposed to submit to the elders in the church? Are we supposed to submit to the government? Are wives to submit to their husbands? And we interpret that as, they get to tell you what to do and you have to do it. But submission is not this rule. They say what goes and you do it. It is one guideline out of many for how to love God and love my neighbor. If I want to live a godly life, then I need to recognize those two realities that I talked about at the beginning. First, some people have a rightful, God-given authority, and God wants me to respect that. Now, that hasn't been Peter's theme, I don't think, so I'm not going to say a lot about that here. But I do want to point out that there are limits to any human authority. For example, as one of the leaders in this church, I have a responsibility for the life of this church, what we are together. If someone came along and tried to convince you all that we should stop teaching the Bible on Sunday morning and instead spend the whole time dancing in the Spirit, I have no problem telling you all, no, that's not what we're going to do. I think I have a responsibility to do that. But the leaders in a church have no business telling you where to work or who to marry, or in fact, most of the things that make up your life, I've got no business telling you what to do, because you have the responsibility for those areas of your life. I don't have responsibility over them. So you have no responsibility to obey a person just because he has some authority over something. And you have no responsibility to submit to any authority that you think is using that authority unrighteously. So this speaks both to the person with authority and the one under him. It is evil for a leader to presume to step outside the bounds of his responsibilities, and no one has a duty as such to follow such a leader. So limited human authority is something to consider as we try to live godly lives. The second aspect is what Peter is talking about, I think. Voluntarily submitting even to unjust authorities for the sake of communicating clearly about the gospel. I said that we have no responsibility to submit to unrighteous authority. I should say that we do not necessarily have that responsibility. I should never submit to anyone calling me to disobey God, that's true. And if I have the freedom to leave, I might, for instance, if you decided that this church is full of it and teaching all kinds of terrible things that are destructive to a person's faith, then you would have the right to fight it and ultimately leave if you don't think that this is the place to be, and so on. But Peter is talking to Christians who have to interact with the world around them. They are in relationships that they must do something with. A citizen under a pagan government, a slave under an unbelieving master, a wife married to an unbelieving husband. Peter wants them to communicate in love that Christianity has not made them the enemy of this one who is their superior in some way. Yes, their faith sets them apart, and they will not go against their conscience, and so there is a clear difference. But in many ways, the citizen, the slave, the wife, in the social situation of the Roman Empire, can show their deference and respect for those who are calling them to submit. They can communicate through their deferential and respectful attitude that they are on the side of their social superiors, not their enemies. That the citizens, the slaves, the wives are people of character whose faith is worth considering. Let me make one more comment. Since Peter is speaking about wives and husbands, and he gives that word to the husband at the end, I would like to end by just commenting on one of the truly great evils that we have seen in the world, the abuse of the concept of submission by Christian husbands. Often it is hard for us to take seriously the idea that the Bible might actually teach headship. And one of the main reasons that we find it hard to take seriously is that it is hard to find an example of the actual practice that is not an abomination and a horror. And I mean that seriously. I have seen many times a so-called Christian husband use the concept of submission as a tool against his wife. I mean, what is more seductive than feeling that God has commanded you to boss people around, to get your own way, and to feel superior and virtuous while you're doing it? I mean, what could be better than that? I'm a good guy and I get to win. I mean, I'm not even a bad guy. I'm not bad for asserting myself and winning. I'm godly in doing it. How can you beat that? That's a great deal. Well, and then you've got the trump card. If your wife calls you on being unloving, you can accuse her of being disobedient to God's will because she's not being submissive. This is not a straw man I am setting up. I have seen it over and over again. That's a reality that happens. I really think that Peter has nailed it here. It is a part of any husband's Christian discipleship that he treat his wife with the respect due a true equal in the faith, because that is what she is. If there is any unique responsibility that a husband has before God, and I think there is, but I could be wrong, that does not free him from the obligation to sacrifice himself and his own wishes for the sake of loving his wife. As Christians, both the husband and the wife are called to sacrifice themselves, each for the other. Okay, so there's plenty to chew on, so we have time now for any questions or comments you might have.
Thank you, Ron. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, when you made a decision that you made earlier in the text, in the early part of 3, given the fact, or given the appearance that in verse 8, and to sum up, he said, let all, I'm assuming that would be husbands and wives. And then in 7, where he's addressing the husbands, I think you called them so-called Christian husbands, I think, or actual Christian husbands. I don't remember which way you went on that. But so, and then the example was Sarah, and Abraham both being believers in that example. Sarah submitting to Abraham, who was considered a believer as well. So earlier on then, why you're seeing the husbands earlier as unbelieving, as opposed to maybe the jury is still out or so-called Christian husband. So my question would be why you made the decision to go to hardcore unbelieving husbands earlier in the third, you know what I mean?
Right.
Opposed to, you know, believing but we're not, you know, professing believing but not acting like it, or uncertain whether the person's believing or not believing.
Right.
Given that the rest of the passage seems to be talking about husbands who are believing, and Sarah making that kind of submission to a believing mate. So I was wondering why you went with stone hard, cold,
right,
dyed in the wool, unbelieving husband. And that's a cool hat, by the way.
So a couple reasons for that. I mean, there's that phrase, even if he is disobedient to the word. And my understanding of the sense of disobedient to the word, looking at that, is not just he's having a bad day or something, but this is basically disobedient in some contexts in the New Testament can really be tantamount to unbelieving, and especially someone disobedient to the word. I think what he's saying is, you may be called upon to submit to a husband who is so far not the sort of person that you as a believer by nature would think, yeah, I can really trust him in this situation, that he is actively antagonistic. He is actively disobedient to the gospel. Secondly, that would make sense in the context as he's going through, is that each of these examples that he's giving, it's all in the larger context, I think, of this issue of how do I, as an alien and stranger, as a believer in the world, interact with the unbelieving world around me. And I think each of these is highlighting a person who is in a situation where they're being called upon to make decisions about how they're going to interact with people. I mean, it's one thing to call me to obey the elders in my church or something, when I have this concept that we're all believers together and we're all pretty much on the same page, but we might have a disagreement here or there. But it's another thing to call me to submit to someone who is actively hostile to the things that are most important to me. So I think he's pushing the extreme for the wives out to having a husband who might be so far not trustworthy in this way that he's actively disobedient to the word, meaning unbelieving. Third, I know that Abraham is a believer, but I don't see Peter emphasizing that in the story. Her trust is not in Abraham's character. Her hope is in God. And it doesn't really, I mean, ultimately, it doesn't really matter. It's not for the wife. See, I'm not saying that the wife has assessed the situation and said, okay, I know that he's definitely not a believer. I mean, there's going to be this whole range of things that a person might find oneself in. But I think he's saying, let's start out here with rank disobedience and unbelief and work it back. That, I mean, what I'm doing is I am communicating my respect for my husband such that however far gone he might be, I can call him back. So, you know, it's quite possible. I mean, everybody debates about the thing with Abraham. Was he like being totally faithless, or is that the point of the story at the spot where he tells Sarah to pretend that she's his sister? But let's just grant the significant possibility that Abraham was not doing things right when he did it at that spot. So is Sarah at this point going to say to herself, well, on average, I think he adds up to be a pretty godly person. Not doing so well at the moment, but I mean, at that point, it doesn't really matter ultimately how trustworthy Abraham is or not. I think what Peter's pointing to is that she hopes in God, and that she can do so without fear, even though the circumstance that she's in could definitely lead one to fear. So anyway, all of that stuff is why I would tend to see it that way. But the admonition really holds. It is always appropriate for me to live in such a way that I sacrifice myself in order to communicate clearly to someone else what I'm about, that I not distract from the picture of what it means to be a loving follower of Christ by choosing this moment to stand on my rights and look like a jerk. So that's why.
Thank you. Very helpful. The most puzzling thing to me is the evaluation of Sarah as godly and faithful.
Mm-hmm.
Where is he getting that?
I don't know.
do you think he's inferring it from the protection that she got and the blessing that she got?
Yeah, most of the stories involving Sarah and Abraham don't really indicate, it's not so much about Sarah's attitude, obedience to Abraham or anything. I mean, they're not even like that. In fact, it's tricky. The one place where she calls him Lord is the place where God has told Abraham, you know, that he's going to have a son, and Sarah's going, so I don't remember the language exactly, but basically, we're going to have a kid, you know, me, I'm old, and my Lord is old. I mean, she refers to Abraham. So at that particular moment, she's kind of incredulous that the whole thing is going to happen, which is not particularly a model of submission to Abraham or trust in God or anything. I mean, it seems like it's a side issue that she happens to use the word Lord. It's just a word she uses. So I think, first of all, Peter is just saying, well, she uses that word. She's not against using that word in reference to Abraham. And in seeing her trust, yeah, that's what strikes me is this text doesn't emphasize her attitude in it, but yeah, she does it, and God certainly, again, it doesn't emphasize this either, but it seems to me that God protects her in that situation. So yeah, I'm just assuming that he is inferring the godliness of her attitude from that. But you're right. I'm a little troubled by that as too, because there's nothing that signals that very strongly in the story. I agree with that. Anything else?
Quick, I'm a little confused. Maybe I checked out at this point. But you're in 7, where it says, so that your prayers may not be hindered. I caught that it wasn't a tit for a tat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more of a, I think what you were getting at is more of an ultimatum. This woman, they're Christians, so accept them as such, or else this could be problematic for your interaction with God. I'm not sure how you quantify that.
Right. I don't know that you can, but I think the warning is, it's the warning that is given in many times when, Peter starts out talking about this sort of thing. Our faith is being tested, he says, and the proof of our faith, the fact that our faith emerges in our life as a reality, is more precious than gold, and that's the theme that he's been talking about. So when we talk about the testing of our faith, we're not talking about individual acts of moral failure or success. I mean, in any marriage, both partners have treated the other in a way that they shouldn't at various times. It's not that. But Peter is calling the husband to to turn away from a model that he might find very comforting and attractive that his society has given him, which is this sort of, you know, I'm the lord of the manor kind of thing, and the wife is kind of one step above the head servant or something like that. That what Peter's saying is, if the gospel is true and you have this believing wife, then if you have that attitude toward her, you don't understand what your faith is about. I mean, and if you would rather cling to that I'm the lord of the manor thing over recognizing the truth of what her relationship to you really is in God's eyes, then what does your faith really mean to you? I mean, how important is this faith if it matters more to you that you get to be the boss or something like that? So that's the kind of thing that I think he's saying. When he's warning, lest your prayers be hindered, he's inviting them to step back. As he goes to spell out here, that he's going to say, following this, basically, that, you know, whether or not you're willing to submit to God in the kinds of things that I'm talking about here says a lot about whether you, in fact, have in your heart submitted to God. Now, we're all going to mess up, and that's not, I mean, it's important to think, when we think about the testing of our faith, that it is not a one strike and you're out kind of deal. And of course, as I've said maybe 30,000 times, Peter himself is the model of that for us. Jesus told the disciples specifically, you deny me before men, and I will deny you before the Father. That's one of those testing your faith kind of deals. So what does Peter do? He denies Jesus before men three times. And then, but that was a moral failure on his part, but it was not ultimately indicative of his attitude toward God. It's just that he had a lot of learning to do. So he's not, this is not justification by works in the sense that, hey, look, prove to me that you've done everything right and then God will be happy with you. But he's saying, if you're really going to embrace the gospel as true, you have to be willing to embrace the truth that your wife is your equal before God, and treat her the way you would treat with respect any other believer before God that matters to you, because they belong to God just as you do.
Could this be applied to Baptists?
Yes, yes. Even Baptists. Okay. Shall we? We're kind of over time, so maybe we'll stop there. Thanks.